We are continuing with our story of David. We're going to quickly jump over our first reading because the first reading is, or the first part of the study is our first reading in church on this morning. Come on, bigger. That's a little too big. In 1 Samuel 16, basically we're kind of leading up to the David and Goliath story. There's a million-dollar question of how old is David when he is called to be king. A couple of things that you need to know. First of all, where is David when Samuel comes to anoint one of the sons of Jesse? He's out watching the sheep, okay? Although the text doesn't say, we're assuming that he's watching the sheep alone because we know the six older brothers have been called in, okay? So based on that kind of assumption, he has to be at least old enough to fend off a wolf, a robber, something like that, okay? So I don't want you to think him so much as 9, 10, 11, 12, okay? Probably 15, 16, you know, as a teenager, you can fight off anybody, right? So in this particular story, okay, we know that Samuel is told by God that you are going to go and anoint one of the sons of Jesse, the Bethlehemite. Okay? From our the handout I gave you last week about David, you can go back and see how we have traced the lineage of David from Ruth down to this point. And what we do know about Jesse is that he's a fairly typical Israelite father in that he's following social convention. Okay? Let me give you an example. Let's say all of you guys are my kids. Okay? If I'm introducing you in this culture, if I'm introducing you, I'm always going to introduce the males first and the oldest first. I'm not going to guess who's the oldest. Yeah. Okay. But there's a specific protocol. Okay. Does anybody know why that is? Why the protocol in an Israelite culture is always the eldest child?
Because of the inheritance
rights. The oldest child is going to get twice the amount of the other children. But the oldest child is also going to have the responsibility of the family business, his mother, if she is still alive, as well as raising the other siblings. Okay? So that's a part of the reason that that is the case. But there's actually another reason, okay, according to the way that Jews believed about things. And that is that they did not realize, they didn't understand about genetics and egg and sperm and all that sort of stuff like we do, okay? For example, women, I hope this is not a shock. I hope you had a good biology teacher. Okay. But women had all the eggs that you were ever going to have when you were born. Everybody conscious of that? Okay, good. Okay. As opposed to man, who continually, in a normal capacity, continue to make sperm all of their life. Okay, we're not born with 87 billion or whatever it is. Okay, it's we continue to make them. Okay. They didn't understand that. And the ancients believed, okay, that there were certain people who were fertile and there were certain people that weren't. And if, when a couple got together, the best egg and the best sperm must have been the strongest, the healthiest, and they got out first, so they get an extra blessing. It wasn't just about the Jewish inheritance rights. It was they believed the oldest child was going to be the strongest and the smartest and the most courageous and have the most gifts. Okay? So by the time you got down to number 6 or 7, as David was number 7, it's kind of like, well, the common thinking of people was you got the leftovers, if you'll pardon the bluntness, okay? So, Samuel is coming to anoint one of the sons of Jesse, and he immediately knows he's in trouble. Why is that? We have an acting king who hasn't died or resigned. Okay? And so they create this story, which basically is going to give Samuel cover for when he comes to Jesse's house. He takes with him a heifer. He's going to, you know, make a sacrifice and invite Jesse to the sacrifice. Okay? See, they didn't do it like we do. Okay? Where, you know, you elect somebody and then you have the installation dinner. They're going to have the party first, and then during the party, they're going to choose the person. So, in this case, okay, when Samuel comes to Jesse, Jesse's immediately suspicious. Do you come peaceably? You know, what are you here for? Okay. What I want you to imagine, everybody knows Samuel. Samuel is old by now. Okay? And they are very fearful because when Samuel shows up, stuff happens. Big, showy, God-type stuff. And so when Samuel shows up, do you come peaceably? Peaceably, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Sanctify yourselves. Come with me to the sacrifice. He sanctified Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. What is Samuel doing here? He is not only acting as prophet, but he's also acting as priest. Okay, and the sanctifying of the sons more than likely was a ritual washing, a mikvah. Okay? When they came, he looked on the kids, oldest to youngest, and lo and behold, he looks at Eliab, the guy with twice the inheritance. Doesn't say he had the coat of many colors or was dad's favorite, but we all know he was. And, you know, surely this is the Lord's anointed. Not. Okay, we're going to go through all of Jesse's sons. And after Eliab, God says something to Samuel that completely changes his perspective. That is, verse 7, "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. The Lord does not see as mortals see. They look on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." So, doesn't matter how tall you are, doesn't matter how good looking you are, doesn't matter that you've got twice the amount of the family money, doesn't matter that you got the best seed, literally. Don't look on that kind of stuff. Look on the heart. And what he sees in David, he likes. David is about as opposite of Saul as you can get. Saul is ruthless. He is, you know, enraged a lot of times at this particular point in his life. And then we have David, the docile shepherd boy, who's out watching the sheep and just trying to play nice. As the story unfolds, and you'll hear a little bit more about this in my sermon, about the significance of that, but the piece I want you to look at is verse 13. Samuel rises up, he takes the horn of oil, and he anoints David in the presence of his brothers. Okay? Guess what? The runt. He's what? King of Israel, anointed by Samuel. We all know Saul's still alive. This isn't going to do him any good. Okay? We don't get that kind of immediate reaction out of the brothers, but you better believe that's really what's happening at this point. And the importance, the significance of the other siblings in Jesse's household pretty much falls by the wayside after this. The only thing we're really going to look at big time is what's happening with David. He's anointed in the presence of his brothers. The Spirit of the Lord comes mightily upon him from that day forward, and Samuel leaves. I'm 15, 16 years old. I've just been anointed king of Israel. There is a standing king of Israel right here in front of me. How do you think David's going to feel about Saul? He's going to be terrified. Because if any of his brothers say anything, word gets back, he is dead meat. And then David, where he should be running from Saul, actually is called into Saul's service. Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. I will tell you, a lot of ink been spilled about this one. We don't like we like the Holy Spirit coming on people and filling them and blessing them and giving them gifts for ministry and empowering them. We don't like to talk about the Spirit leaving. And even worse, we think the evil spirit should come from a source other than God. I agree with all of that. Okay? The Old Testament point that's being made here is the transition of authority and power begins when Saul is still in power. And there's a reason that God has David in the company of King Saul. And that would be
what? You get to know how to be king.
As bad a king as he was, at least you, I mean, this is a shepherd boy. He doesn't know how to rule the people of Israel. He doesn't know everybody. Okay. It would definitely do good in the chick department, although obviously we learn later in life he doesn't seem to have a big problem with that, because he was ruddy and handsome after all.
Beautiful eyes.
Okay, but something interesting is going on in the text. Let our Lord now command the servants who attend you to look for someone who is skillful in playing the lyre. And when the evil spirit from God is upon you, he will play it and you will feel better. So Saul said to his servants, provide for me someone who can play well not just play well, bring him to me. One of the young men answered, I've seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing, a man of valor, a warrior, prudent in speech, a man of good presence, and the Lord is with him. So Saul sent messengers to Jesse, said, send me your son David, who is with the sheep. Okay, now we know what he's been doing. He went back to being a shepherd boy. Apparently the brothers have kept their tongue. Okay, but as soon as, I'll get your question in just a second, as soon as Jesse learns that Saul has sent for David, what Jesse's probably thinking is, I'm never going to see him alive again.
Never going to
see him alive again.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, isn't this an echo of another story about the least being the elevated to the top position? I just keep hearing an echo in my brain, but I don't know what it is.
Jacob and Esau.
Okay.
Remember, he stole the birthright, but it was the younger, oh my gosh, and then God gave him a gift of interpreting dreams. Okay? And can't you just imagine standing out with your brothers and explaining a dream who says, and the younger will bow down, or the olders will bow down to the younger? Really? And we're going to see the same thing happening again? Thank you for pointing that out. The reason that this is going on, the Lord does not see as mortals see. The Lord knows, this is the one I want. May not make sense to you, but those of you who are old-time Episcopalians, you remember the song. God is working his purpose out as year succeeds to year. God is working his purpose out and the time is drawing near. Nearer and nearer draws. The time and the time that will surely be when the earth shall be filled with the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. God's working his purpose out. It might not be with who you think, but David is the one you want to watch. He's now put David into Saul's court. Okay? Now, I am convinced, beyond being able to be unconvinced, that God is in control of everything. And if you think you're here by accident, you and I need to have a talk. Okay? If he's going to go to this kind of pains, okay, to have this happen, I have another story I can tell you. When I left New Jersey, there was a particularly awkward, rather niggling experience that most laity don't know about. Just like you have a membership letter, clergy have a letter, but it's called a letter demissory. And you are a member not of a parish, but of a diocese. And so in order to move from diocese to diocese, you have to be released by your bishop, and your new bishop has to welcome you, and all of that routine. So we kind of had a little trouble getting my letter from New Jersey, which Bishop Howe ultimately took care of. And so I was not able, when I came back to Florida, I wasn't able to function and do anything in the church. I couldn't supply, I couldn't fill in for people. I know you're all so surprised. But anyway, when I finally got my letter demissory, Rob Goodridge called and said, I'm going to be gone for 3 weeks. Can you come and handle services? Sure, absolutely. Fun. Happy to do it. And, oh yes, I get paid again. So I whisk off, and who do I meet? Carla. The very first time I served on the altar with her, I went to her and I said, you want to finish the story?
I'll let you finish.
No, go ahead.
This is your story. But you had never seen such well-trained lambs.
And all of the people around the acolyte, I said, who is it that does this? Because I want them to come to St. David's and help train our people. And look how God answered that. And she came to St. David's. Yes.
There must have been some time, quite a bit of time that passed between when David was anointed and when they're telling Saul about him. Did they call him a warrior? Did they call him a man of valor? That's got to be some period of time so we can demonstrate this. And then how do you demonstrate that? There's a war going on.
Oh, there is a war going on.
Is he active in the war or is he watching the sheep?
At this point, we're not told. We learn that later. Okay? And it also could have been that there was a little mythic heightening. Okay? Not that you've ever heard of anyone padding their resume. No. No. Okay. So, man of valor, warrior, prudent in speech, man of good presence, the Lord's with him. So Saul sent messengers to Jesse, send me your son David who's with the sheep. Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread, skin of wine, a kid, and sent them by his son David to Saul. And this is... what's he sending the donkey for? Grease the skids a little bit. Okay. But, okay, see, the real question here is, what's really going on? If the king sends for you as a musician to come serve and come to his court, you kind of think, I'm under orders of the king. I need to skedaddle there right now, leave, whatever. Okay, it could be that the gift of transportation, if you will, was kind of, you're coming now whether you want to or not. This is not an offering for Jesse. You know, this isn't a sacrifice, you know, anything like that. It's, you know, what is to prevent me from doing this? Well, nothing, because here's food, here's wine, here's a donkey, get on, come now. David came to Saul, entered his service. Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. Okay? Ceremonial armor of a king, okay, was typically very ornate, typically gold, okay, heavy. You're getting my drift, okay? See, later on, the king is going to come and offer David his armor. And so oftentimes what happens is people interpret that as David's too little, he can't, you know, carry it, or David's not accustomed to having this kind of thing. He was his armor bearer. Yes, he is very used to accompanying it. But what David is basically saying by rejecting the armor is not, I'm too little, it's too heavy, I can't use it. It's, I'm going to trust God, and I'm not going to trust armor. Let David remain in my service. He's found favor in my sight. Whenever the evil spirit from God, I just want to be very clear, as much as you might not like the evil spirit sent from God, this is the third or fourth time in this chapter that they've been very clear to point that out. Okay? Whenever this spirit of unrest came upon Saul, David would take the lyre, play it, Saul would feel better, and the evil spirit would depart from him. After that story, we move to the David and Goliath story. Now, I'm sure you all have colored Bible coloring books with this story. Okay, forget everything you know and every picture you've ever seen, because when all else fails, go to the text and see what it says. The first thing that I want to say to you is, I've often said how important it is that you look at what someone's name means, and it will give you insights into the story that you might not get otherwise. Ruth is a classic example. Ruth has two kids, Mahlon and Chilion. So you look up in a biblical dictionary and you say, what do these guys' names mean? Weakling and pining. You better not count on these guys staying around very long. You get my drift? And we're not two sentences into the story. Both of the sons take a wife and then they die. Okay? This is one of those stories that you need to know what the word Goliath means. Anybody have a clue?
Try it.
You're going to be very surprised. Soothsayer.
What?
Soothsayer.
Soothsayer.
It means either soothsayer or a person in exile. Now, in either case, he's not going to get along with the Israelites. Okay? Because, and again, it makes a lot more sense if we know that his name is soothsayer, because we know what issue Saul has ordered that all the soothsayers and necromancers, the people who consult the dead, and mediums and wizards have been are going to be banished from the kingdom. So that he is a soothsayer, someone who divines knowledge by extraordinary means other than God, just as one more bad thing to put on Goliath's resume. Let's pull a couple of things from the text. Okay. In the Bible talking about Saul, as Joy pointed out last week, Saul was tall. Okay. How tall was Saul?
6 cubits and a span.
6 cubits and a span. Nice try. That's what it says. Okay. Typically, okay, in 1 Samuel, I wrote this down, chapter 9, verse 2, Saul from his shoulders and up was taller than any of the people. So literally what the text says is if everybody is as tall as Dez, okay, from the shoulders up, he was taller than that. He was a head taller. Okay. If the tallest Israelite is 6 foot, that's going to put Saul at 7. Goliath is 9. Okay. Would have been drafted first round NBA, no question. Let's talk a little bit about where Goliath comes from and what has happened. In this part of Israel, the Philistines have set up shop. They actually are kind of the ISIS of their day, if you'll pardon that analogy. They basically ran out the Canaanites from Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gath. So there's kind of a 5-city area that they kind of oversee. If we go back far enough in ancient Israelite history, we know that this area was the area that the Phoenicians, the ancient Phoenicians, originally controlled. There are some people who feel that the Philistines are descendants of the Phoenicians. If that's so, then we're missing one huge, if you'll pardon the pun, textual piece, and that is the Phoenicians were not terribly tall people. Okay, was this a genetic fluke or whatever? Who knows? Okay, but we know the first time outside of the Bible that the Philistines actually appear is in about the 13th century BC. They appear in the Bible earlier. But outside of Scripture, the first time they occur is about the 13th B.C. We have two very interesting Bible study pieces of trivia. Okay? And if you think it's difficult and you get into some crazy debates in the New Testament, the Old Testament's even worse. The word Philistine comes from the Hebrew word Pelestim, okay, that is found 286 times in the Hebrew Bible. This is not some Johnny come lately, we only hear about him in one story. It goes all the way back to Genesis 26, where we see that Exodus 26, where the Israelites, when they are leaving Egypt, they are told not to go to the land of the Philistines. Okay? So don't think we have to wait until we get to David to start hearing about the Philistines or Goliath. They've been a long-standing problem. What do we know about them? Okay? From the story, we know that Goliath was tall. We know that they had armies that people were terribly afraid of. Okay? There's a couple of other little pieces that the Bible gives us a hint at why they were so superior in battle. And that is, they perfected the ability to work in iron. The Israelites didn't have that technology. So although they hated the Philistines, they bought their metal farm implements from them, and they had to take them back to be sharpened. So just in terms of day in and day out trade, the Philistines had constant interplay with the Israelites. A part of what we know outside of the Bible is that when they would go to buy implements and they found out an Israelite was purchasing it, they jacked the price up. And when they took their farm implements to be sharpened, okay, the people from Egypt paid a different rate than the Israelites did. Okay? They're not happy about that. So there were lots of reasons for there to be conflict between the two. Remember I said Pelestim, 286 times in the Hebrew Bible. Let's jump forward to the Greek version of the Old Testament. In the Greek version, which is the Septuagint, the word only occurs 12 times. Every other time, it is translated differently, allophilos. Allophilos, which means of another tribe. Okay, so, okay, what do we take from that? Okay, the Jewish version of the Old Testament is very anti-Philistine. And any time they can rub their noses in it, they're going to kind of get it. But by the time it gets worked down a little bit with the Greeks, they don't have that fierce hatred and antagonism. And so they only use that word when the text absolutely demands it. And all 12 are in this chapter of 1 Samuel. Yeah?
Putting it into some sort of historical perspective, then, the era of the judges were before this time.
Right.
And we know that Samson was a judge, and
he fought the Philistines.
He kicked some tail against the Philistines.
Yes, he did.
According to the Bible.
I've not ever heard it put quite that way, but that must be the Catholic version.
I guess it was.
Could you repeat his question?
He's in the process of, I think, asking.
Okay. Okay, so the question would be, if Samson was before this time, and he did engage the Philistines himself in the jawbone of an ass according to the Bible, then it would seem that they go back quite a ways. I don't know how far back Samson goes. I'd say 500 years, 300 years, or Judges' time?
Hundreds.
Hundreds anyway.
Yeah.
It seems that the Philistines are very well known to the Israelites. In fact, didn't Delilah wake him up by saying the Philistines are upon you?
Very well known and very well feared.
Okay.
They were very fierce warriors.
Way back, all the way back.
And fierce not just in terms of the size of their armies, the numbers of warriors, but they were, for example, when the Israelites kill people, okay, the implication of the text typically is that they kill them with a sword, and then after the battle is over, whoever wins, you know, the next phase is you go through and you gather the spoils. Hope everybody realizes that's what really happens, okay? And it never says that I won't say never, rarely says that they would like behead them or do anything that was just particularly grotesque. Okay, that David beheads Goliath is huge. He's basically saying, I'm going to give you back what you've been doing to us over and over and over, and we're going to kind of parade it around, because everybody knew what 9-foot Goliath looked like. Okay. I mean, he was feared by both the Philistines and the Israelites as well. Yes?
Was Goliath's height unusual for the Philistines, or were the Philistines overall hard to call?
Unusual even for the Philistines, yes. Okay. Saul and the Israelites gathered and camped in the valley of Elah, and formed ranks against the Philistines. Okay, what I want you to envision, okay, is that the Israelites were never really good warriors. But people like the Philistines, they would go and they would, and the Romans later did the same thing, they would go camp around the foot of the mountain where the other soldiers were, just to kind of say, we're here. At Masada, there were 12 camps of Roman soldiers all around the base of the mountain. And they were there for over 2 years while they built the incline to take the equipment up. Okay, let's get a picture of Goliath. There came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. A cubit, very simply, is the length from your elbow to the tip of your middle finger. It is typically 18 inches on most people. Okay? So you multiply 18 times 6 and a span. Now, span is this way, crossways. That's a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, which the Philistines weren't known as workers of bronze. They were known as workers of iron. So this would probably have been something that he got off somebody else. And even more kind of intimidating piece of battlement that he would have been able to get someone's helmet. He was armed with a coat of mail. Don't think of European feudal coats of mail. The coat of mail that would have been common at this time would be more like fish scales. Probably little iron plates that would have been pieced together. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, was armed with a coat of mail. The weight of his coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. He had greaves of bronze on his legs, shin guards on his legs, a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, okay, about a little bit smaller than a baseball bat, okay. His spearhead weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves. Let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." The Philistine said, "Today I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all of Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Okay. Here we see Saul at his worst. You got a 9-foot guy, you got a 7-foot king, and you got short Israelites everywhere else. Who are the Israelites expecting is going to go into battle?
Saul.
And what's he going to take with him? The Ark of the Covenant. It's back in their possession. Okay? They expect God to fight this battle. Saul fails miserably in his leadership, in his oversight of the army of the Israelites. And to make matters worse, Goliath is going to go out every day for 40 days and taunt them. Evelyn, I expect something to come out of your mouth. This sounds like another Bible story I've heard about. Okay? Not the 40 days. Okay? This should remind you of another very common, very well-known Bible story when Elijah is taunting the prophets of Baal. Oh, did I fail to mention Goliath and the Philistines also worship Baal? And do you remember Elijah? Okay, I hate the Living Bible with every cell in my body. But if you own one or have access to one, you have to read the story of Elijah taunting the prophets of Baal. Because in the Living Bible, what it actually says is, as Elijah's taunting the prophets of Baal, remember, if you don't know this story, they go up to Mount Carmel, they build, set up an altar of sacrifice, they put a heifer on it, and they invite the prophets of Baal to call fire down from heaven. And they dance and they cut themselves and they beat music and they do all crazy. Nothing happens. Okay? It gets to be Elijah's turn. He walks up. He has, big, huge gallons of water thrown on the sacrifice. He says one little short prayer. Fire comes down, it consumes the sacrifice, it consumes the sticks, it consumes the rocks, it consumes the water, and then it consumes the prophets. But in the taunting, what Elijah says to the prophets of Baal is, "Where's your God? Is he like sitting on the toilet or something?" I mean, it literally says that in one of the reasons I hate the Living Bible, but anyway. Okay, couple more things, and then we're going to have to stop. Today I defy the ranks of Israel. Okay, he's not just taunting Saul. He's not just taunting all of the army Okay. Pick anybody. Pick your greatest warrior. Send him down here. Okay. Nobody will go. Saul isn't going to go. He's got the Ark of the Covenant that makes him invincible in battle. He chooses not to use it because the last time we fought with the Philistines, they won. And they took the Ark. They had it for 7 months. We just got it back. We don't want to risk losing our God. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed, greatly afraid. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had 8 sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years, the 3 eldest sons. Do you notice what's happening? We're picking up another oral tradition. It's telling us all stuff that we've already learned previously. Okay? And so now we have a different writer stepping into the fray and saying, now let me pick up the story here. So oftentimes in the Old Testament, we fail to see this is one of those classic examples where the editors of the Old Testament said, whatever oral tradition we have right here, we like this story better. So we're going to put this story in next. We need to break because of time. I'm sorry. We will pick up there at verse 12. Go on with the David and Goliath story. And we will go, hopefully next week, through the death of Saul. Saul, ultimately, he is wounded in battle, but he's going to commit suicide.
I just have one question.
Yes.
Saul's the king. Saul has to have spies everywhere. How could he let David into his court when David had been anointed as the king?
Okay. The only people apparently that know are Jesse, his brothers, and Samuel, and none of them are talking. It is that if they believe all the brothers saw it, they know this is going to be the next king of Israel. Do you want to take a chance in getting him mad at you?
Your family.
I wouldn't. If you know, they don't trust anybody in the story, but they do trust Samuel. Okay. And if Samuel has put his imprimatur, his stamp of approval, on him, nobody's going to touch him. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Sorry we got to
a bad breaking point in the story. We're just getting to the good part.